Hello and welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast. Me, Matt Beadle, here with the voice of goalkeeping, Richard Lee.
Hello there.
Hello there. Now, this is a slightly different podcast in the sense that we've decided to record two. So it's two podcasts with the same goalkeeper, but this particular show today is part one.
Yes, it is. This particular goalkeeper that we're going to speak to has had quite a history, a lot to talk about, so it doesn't feel like we can do it justice in just one podcast.
No, so we're going to do a part one and then look out for part two, which will arrive shortly, maybe next week, maybe the week after. Who knows? Who knows what happens in the life of a goalkeeper?
Patience is a virtue.
Indeed it is. Well, this week's guest is a man who made his pro debut just 3 years after taking up goalkeeping. He once jokingly described himself as a journeyman by the age of 22 before three promotions, a bag of Player of the Year awards and an England call-up, followed with the likes of Motherwell, Norwich and currently Wolverhampton Wanderers. John Ruddy, the Iceman, welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast.
The Iceman, I haven't heard that for years.
Talk me through that. That was a nickname from back in the day, right? Not used so much now.
That was when I had hair, that's why.
Is that why?
That was when I was at Cambridge, just started out, and a coach I had at the time, Dave Muir, was just doing, you know, you do lookalikes and say what people look like, and he just pulled out Iceman for me from Top Gun. And it literally stuck from that day with all the lads. So all the lads that I played or at Cambridge still refer to me as Iceman now. So yeah, it's a semi-private joke, but yeah, like I said, it sounded better when I had hair.
Can we just quickly clarify the hair business? Because as a man who's also just slightly struggling up top, I don't like to think of it as struggling up top. I like to think of it as becoming a mannequin. That's the way I look at it. But with regards to yours, you've always had a skinhead from what I remember. So what's the crack with your hair? Do you have it? Do you choose to have a skinhead, or did it go early and you just went early?
I think in the term that most people use is my fullback's pushed on really early. So it was sort of taken out of my hands, I'd say. But having said that, I think I took the decision to shave my head when I went to Motherwell. So that I was about 23. And honestly, it's been the best decision ever. It's, you know, you wake up in the morning, there's not a lot of fuss. Yeah. Up you get, hair's done, don't have to worry about what you look like. And like I said, because I was already slightly challenged in that aspect, it was an easy decision to make anyway.
Do you know, I've just got to touch it. He won't mind me digging him out on this, but David Button, of course, has a skinhead now. But he was one. You know, you've got that moment where you make the decision to either go or not, and you hang on. But he got to the point where not only had the fullbacks pushed on, the fullbacks had been substituted. They were gone, you know, and he was still clinging on for so long and eventually made the decision to do it. And in fairness, actually, it suits him as well. It is that decision. Did you ever think about, I mean, I went down the road of the hair transplant, which I think is quite well known. Did you ever think about going down that road?
Briefly, but because what they do, they take hair from the back of your head, don't they? Is that what they do?
Yeah, they do, yeah.
And then put it on the top. See, I haven't got much at the back either. So what they would have had to do was take hair probably from like my chest, which would have meant I would have gone from looking like I do now to looking like Marilyn Fellaini. So it probably would have been one extreme to the other. So, but no, like I said, I'm happy with the decision I made.
Brilliant. Just to clarify, just for anyone listening in, this is the Goalkeepers Union podcast.
Say, yeah. We will bring it back. And I'm glad you said chest, by the way, John. I said at the top there, just to bring it back to goalkeeping, I said at the top, and this amazed me when looking at your career, and I had no idea this was the case. You only started goalkeeping. The first time you stepped between the sticks was at the age of 14. Is that correct? And then you made your debut for Cambridge at 17, just 3 years later.
Technically, the first time I ever played in goal was I was 10, playing for an under-12 team, because the goalkeeper lost his head in the warm-up and stormed off, and they sort of just chucked me in. I never played in goal after that or before that. So, yeah, it was about 14. My team, local team, folded. A coach had set up another team and sort of said, why don't you try in goal? So I was like, okay, I'm at the age now where I thought I'd had a couple of trials at Cambridge outfield. It wasn't working out. So I thought, yeah, what have I got to lose? And yeah, so 14, I probably started taking it, not seriously, but that was my new position, yeah.
And it's staggering that you then were picked up, I would imagine, from that team to play for Cambridge. And 3 years later, I mean, it was the final day of the season, right? 03-04, you eventually came into the side for your debut. What often happens with a young goalkeeper, a token appearance on the last day of the season? I think, Rich, you had something similar. You came in, you saved a penalty and kept a clean sheet, so a great start to life, but so soon after you'd even decided to take up the position.
Yeah, and I think it says a lot about how I am in terms of a person, and you know, once I'm trying something and once I enjoy something, I want to know everything about it. You know, that's like my personality. It's like, you know, I took up golf late, but I can't play enough golf. Do you know what I mean? Now, but if you would have spoke to me 10 years ago, I would have said golf's the worst sport in the world. But you know, once I get into it, I'm fully in, fully invested, and you know, I really want to become a lot better than I am. So that was exactly the same as goalkeeping. I got into it. As you said, I was fortunate enough to get picked up by Cambridge, and once I was given that opportunity, it was like, right, how much can I learn and how quickly can I learn it? And I was very fortunate. I had coaches who believed in me, goalkeeper coaches that broke everything down for me and made it easier for me to learn. And also, you know, the club were very patient, but they understood that the advantage I had in terms of the physical attributes I had obviously doesn't need work on. So then it's purely about technique and fine-tuning, if you like, those basic attributes of goalkeeping. So it was all good.
As much as this podcast is going to be touching on your career and lots of stories, etc., like I'm fascinated on this, something you just said there about the moment you made the decision, you were dedicated, I'm assuming you made several sacrifices, had the discipline in order to see it through and become what you've become and are still doing. For a lot of the younger goalkeepers that are listening in now, do you think that's quite key? Because there'll be a lot of goalkeepers listening that might be, say, 14, 15 years old, maybe at a club, maybe getting close to the level of joining an academy, but might still be playing other things at school, basketball, tennis, cricket, whatever it might be. Would you suggest that it makes sense to hyper-focus on a certain area?
I think you get to a point where it has to be that way. I was in a similar situation. My school and my PE teacher in particular was really big on rugby, and he really felt I could have a chance at playing rugby at a high level. But then it became literally a choice between rugby and football. And because I was already in at Cambridge at the time, it was a fairly easy choice for me to make. But I think it's, you know, I think up until the age of 13, 14, I think you have to be adaptable to most sports. You know, I see a lot of kids now going into academies at 8, 9, 10 years old, and football is all they know, and their only exercise comes from football. And I don't think that's right to a certain extent, because there's so many different attributes you can pick up from the different areas of different sports: hand-eye coordination, balance, footwork, all of these things that will make you better at football, but you'll learn in different sports. So, you know, I've always said I wouldn't ever change the way I got into it, because I had the grounding, if you like, with everything else attributed to that, to then help it easier for me to transition into football full time. You know, my son now, he's 12 years old, and I tell him, play as much sport as you can. You know, if you're at school, join the cricket club, the rugby club, the tennis club, whatever they're doing, try and be a part of it, because it will all help you do what you want to do. And I think a lot of kids this day and age are sort of sucked into the mentality of, I've got to get into the academy as quick as I can. Well, you don't really, because if you're going to be good enough, whether you're 8 years old and in an academy, you're probably still going to develop at the same, maybe a little bit quicker, but you're going to develop to a similar level by the time you're 12 and 13 years old. The only difference is you physically you're going to get bigger and stronger, and you'll have to manage that aspect as opposed to a technical aspect.
Does this also feed in, John, to the notion that you were only, you know, 17, 18 playing regular first team football in League Two? And there's a lot to be said with being at a top flight club when you're young, because you're learning from some great players in training. But in terms of the setup now, where we have under 23 football and the reserve system has kind of been pushed aside, you were a young player playing in League Two, coming up against what I would imagine, without wishing to be too cliche, big burly centre forwards, big burly centre backs coming up from corners. Was that more beneficial to your development, would you say, rather than being in those very, very early years with a top flight club playing what is, I presume, not too competitive under 23 football?
Absolutely. You know, from my point of view, like you say there, I remember it vividly, playing against the likes of Leo Fortune West, and the ball coming over the top. You know, it's come into my hands. There was no chance he was getting the end of it. He was probably a second or two late, and he still ran into me with a forearm into the face. And you're thinking, you know, would that happen in reserve team football, 23s football? Of course it wouldn't. you know, but that was a welcome to the league kid. And, you know, you get corners swinging on top of you. It was the old thing, put it on top of the keeper. You know, it's the old cliches. See if he catches the first one, fair play. If he doesn't, do it again. If he doesn't do it, do it again, do it again. You know, and obviously you could get away with a lot more back then, but, you know, I was always, like I said, I was always physically more developed for my age than a lot of people were. So that aspect of it wasn't too bad. It was more of the shock of taking the hits and being prepared for that and being able to stand up to that and dust yourself off and go again. And like I said, you just don't get that sort of thing in under-23 football. You know, all the football's really good and really pretty, and technically they're very good players, but, you know, if they need to mix it up, can they do that? And that's the question mark over a lot of the kids nowadays. And I think for a development phase, I think you look at the EFL trophy, I think it's a fantastic way for the under-23s to go out there, see what it is about playing against people who will not take any nonsense, who are playing literally for that paycheck at the end of the month. You know, I used to play with guys who would rely on win bonuses because it meant they'd be able to get something extra at the end of the month for their kids or their missus, or, you know, they were relying on that sort of bonus, and you can't ever take that for granted. And that's why I feel at the minute the under-23 football is good in terms of developing technical players, but are you ever going to develop them in terms of mentality as well? That's the question mark.
No, absolutely. And for yourself personally, your first full season at the club as a pro was successful. Like I said, from a personal point of view, Cambridge actually went down from League Two that season, went into the Conference. You then quite incredibly got the move to Everton as a result of that. So an absolutely epic jump. I think it was the season that they'd even managed to get into the Champions League, if I'm right. But there were 9 loan spells during that time. We talk a lot about loans, and we've gone into it a fair bit on this show before, so we won't delve right into the intricacies of each particular loan, but there were a couple that I just wanted to very quickly touch on. The first one was the first loan move, and that was to Walsall. Now, I remember interviewing Paul Merson around this time when he was boss of Walsall. It was around the mid-noughties, wasn't it? And there was a question about goalkeeping, and it was mentioned that the club didn't have a goalkeeper coach at the time. Were you there at that time?
Yeah.
Staggering. So there was no goalkeeper coach and you went there on loan?
Yeah. I would train with Everton for like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then go down to Walsall Thursday, Friday for the game at the weekend. And they used to have a guy, Andy Oakes was a goalkeeper down there at the time. He was injured. So he would try and do a bit of a session, but he had a leg injury, so he couldn't do any serving and anything. They maybe had a guy come in once or twice a week. In all honesty, it definitely wasn't a specialised goalkeeper coach, put it that way. It was weird coming from a setup like Cambridge, where even at Cambridge I had a goalkeeper coach who was very good and helped me massively, to go to Everton, where obviously I'm working with someone like Chris Woods, who's an international footballer in his day, you know, top class goalkeeper. And then you go to Walsall and it's like everything's a bit mix and mash, and you don't really know where you're training one day to the next, and it was strange. But you know, you make by, or you get by as best you can, and it was a difficult spell for me. I think in hindsight, from my point of view and Everton's point of view, I think a couple of the loans would have been picked a little bit better. And I think the main thing for me would be having gone from, like you said, a Conference team effectively in Cambridge who got relegated to a Champions League team. I think you need a lot longer to adapt to the standards, the personalities, the demands that are placed on you at a club like Everton, coming from where I came from. I probably would have, in hindsight, stayed at Everton for the first 6 months until January and see what happened, see how I developed there, and if they felt a loan move would have been beneficial then to go out. But as a player, you know, I'd come off the back of playing, I think, 38 games for Cambridge that season. I was injured over Christmas for a few games. I didn't want to stop playing. You know, I've worked hard to get into the team. As you say, personally, I've done well for my age and inexperience. So I didn't want to stop that week in, week out men's football. But, you know, the decision was to go out on loan, to continue playing games. Unfortunately, certainly that first season, I think there was 3 loans that first season, one to Walsall, Rushton, and then to Chester. None of them really worked out as we would have liked, unfortunately.
It is fascinating, actually, because you got that balance between development and playing time. And I suppose you've just given a great example there as to when you go out, and I know there's a lot of top teams that actually struggle with this, is that they'll send their players on loan and they'll get the game time in the Football League, which of course is key, but then they'll often come back to their parent club and they won't be as fit. They won't have developed in the way in which the club want them to develop. So it's a bit of a catch-22, because as you touched on, under-23 football, certainly for goalkeepers, and I mean, I played 23s in my last season before I retired, and you know, it made me think I could play at the top level again, because it was so easy, really, for a goalkeeper. Then all of a sudden, you go down into League 2, and you're dealing with the tough conditions. You've got the balls put in on your head. The pitches aren't as good, etc., etc., and it is a completely different game of football. So it's quite tough to get that balance. I guess one of the key messages would be, if you are a number two, and in fact Jonathan Bond's done this at West Brom as a good example, where he went there and under Neil Cutler he effectively reshaped his game over a 6 month period. Sometimes you need to do that, don't you? You need to take a step back, and almost, if you're not playing week in, week out, that is the opportunity to work on your power, your speed, your technical ability, your tactical awareness and everything else. Have you had plenty of time early on to do that, did you feel? Were you able to do that throughout all these loans?
No, not really. And as you touched on there, with adapting to different ways of working as well, different coaches and different styles that they want you to do. You know, I was, like I said, because I came into goalkeeping so late, I was so eager to learn and take on information that meant whatever goalkeeper coach I worked with, you know, and I'm a firm believer in, as a goalkeeper, you take lead from your coach. You know, your coach is there to help you, he's there to develop you, he's there to help. So I would always try and take on board what they were wanting. So I'd gone from, it's a simple thing like a scoop save, you know, from a bouncer or something, a dipper, you know, gone from one technique where you're scooping it up and you're taking it to the floor and anything in and around your feet you're trying to scoop up, to go into working with Chris Woods where it's like, right, we'll just get your hands out to the side and just block the ball. And that was quite difficult for me to adjust to that technique, because I just felt like I had nothing behind my hands to stop the ball going past. If my hands didn't connect properly, it was a goal, you know, because I had no barriers in behind, or my foot, you know, my feet didn't get across. And so you're flipping from different techniques, being told to do one thing, get into the game, you do what you feel is natural and what you're used to doing, to then being told, no, I want you to try this again. And, you know, all of a sudden, there's an overload of information and you're going, oh, I don't know what's going on. You know, I don't know what to do. So then you end up caught in no man's land and trying to make saves with a hand and a foot at the same time and getting in your own way almost. So I think that was the problem. And like I said, if I could have had that 6 month period at Everton working with Woodsy and just seeing what he wanted from me and trying to nail down the techniques that he thought would help me moving forward, and then we could put it into games. You know, even play reserve team football at Everton, because back then you were still playing with four or five first team players. They just hadn't played the week before, so they needed a game that week. And that's where I think reserve team and under 23 football is flawed at the moment, because it's not a first team environment. Although they're trying to pass it off as similar to the first team, it's not, because you haven't got four, five, six first team players who weren't in the squad last week playing this week. That's difficult to comprehend as well.
Well, speaking of first team players, Nigel Martin and Richard Wright were the goalkeepers when you arrived at Everton, John. And it's incredible, to be fair, how often Richard Wright crops up on this podcast. Scott Loach said that he was his hero. He obviously grew up in Ipswich and later played for the club. We're going to speak to Nick Pope. At some point, he was in the academy at Ipswich, so he looked up to Richard Wright. We should probably, Rich, get Richard Wright on the podcast to talk about himself at some point. But they were the goalkeepers when you arrived at Everton, John. You were there for 5 years. So rather than go into it, because you only played one game for the club, I just want to bookend it. And we're going to start with that debut, because that was an absolute madness. Now, I can't tell you how many times, and maybe you guys will be able to shed more light on this and it's just the norm, but the amount of times a goalkeeper that we have on the podcast that made his debut as a young goalkeeper off the bench, be that because of a sending off, be that because of an injury, but at the time you made your debut, it was against Blackburn, John, and both Nigel Martin and Richard Wright were injured. You know all this. Ian Turner had come in. He was another young goalkeeper who actually I'd seen in the lower leagues. He'd spent time on loan in that 05-06 season. He was sent off. You had to come on as early as 10 minutes.
Yeah, and I wasn't even sure if I was going to be on the bench that game either. I didn't know if David Moyes was going to name a goalkeeper on the bench. So, yeah, to go from that to 10 minutes in to being on the pitch, it was quite surreal. it's the old cliche, isn't it? But once you get over that white line, it's just another game. And to be fair, the lads...
Is it really like that, though, John? Because obviously you're a young goalkeeper at the time. You're coming into a Premier League environment just 10 minutes into a game. A feisty atmosphere, I would imagine. Ian Turner had to go off. It was a free kick as a result of that. Are you just thinking, whatever I do, I must not make a mistake here?
Well, no, it was right on the edge. So it was a shooting free kick. They had a clear shot of goal. So it was just like, right, get the wall set up. Just stay, protect your side of the goal. If it comes that way, make the save. If not, do your best. Luckily for me, they missed the target, and then you could sort of try and manage the game as best you can. And obviously, I think with having the experience of playing a full season in men's football already and being in different environments where you're either chasing a game, defending a lead, or, you know, there's an edgy game that you need to just quieten the whole tempo down. I think, you know, we done that really well. And like I said, I had some great lads in that team. I think Alan Stubbs, David Weir, Nuno Valente were... Tony Hibbert, so, you know, that's massively experienced back four there. So they were fantastic with me. And yeah, we done really well that game, and I was pleased with my contribution. I think I only really had one save to make and maybe a couple of crosses. So in all fairness, it was a fairly quiet outing. But
yeah, incredible. I mean, you touched earlier on your personality, and I just want to touch on it here because you said you crossed the white line. It's the same as any other game. One of the themes that I've noticed with a lot of the goalkeepers we spoke to on this show is that the very best seem to have quite a calm personality. Already speaking to you, I get the impression that you are a very calm character. So stepping on in that moment, I could imagine for a lot of emotional goalkeepers, that could be one of those moments where you get a lot of adrenaline, the emotions that will be pumping through at that moment could be very difficult to deal with. Do you think the fact that you have got quite a calm personality helped you in that moment?
I think so, and I think that's the same with anything in life. I think if you spoke to my wife, she gets frustrated with me because I'm so laid back at home. You know, she and you know you've trained all that time and throughout your early life or your career and to get to that point. So you've got to enjoy it while you're there. And I think the biggest thing for me and the biggest thing that I was ever taught to never chase a game. You know, let the game come to you. You don't need to go. As a goalkeeper, you don't need to go and chase that through ball. You don't need to go and chase that cross or force a save. You know, just let it come to you. Do what you've been doing in training, in previous games, and it will fall into place. And you know, so if you make a mistake, you know what? You make a mistake. These things happen. You know, you're not the first, and you won't be the last goalkeeper to make a mistake. So you can't then affect that mistake because it's been and gone. The only thing you can affect is your next action. And I think as long as you've got that ability to, certainly for those 90 minutes, to get that mistake out of your head for the rest of the game, move on and try and do your best in the rest of the game, you know, then afterwards comes the point of analysis where you can go, right, let me see that back again. Okay, that's what I've done wrong. This is what we need to do. Moving forward, done. And you put it to bed because goalkeeping is, as we all know, it's a very tough position. Mentally, you have to be... very strong, very switched on most or all of the time, and also able to bail other people out. You know, you have to be the one to make up for someone else's mistake, you know, but you also have to understand that nobody can really help you if you make a mistake. And I think as long as you've got the right balance between understanding what you can and can't affect, you'll go far because you'll be able to put them out of your head and analyse it as and when you can or when it's necessary to.
Oh, Stubbs. Oh, and the goalkeeper comes now. Did he use his hand? Now, that stopped a goal-scoring opportunity. It would have been one-on-one. And what a tough call this is for Ian Turner. If the referee sticks to the letter of the law, Gary, he's got to go.
I think that's very, very harsh.
The young Scot was controversially sent off, prompting yet another goalkeeping debut, this time for John Ruddy. It was an incident that really fired the home support into life, and the performance didn't disappoint.
You obviously had a great time at Norwich after Everton, John, but can you just describe to us exactly how that move came about? Because, as I understand it, you were in Manchester Airport, you were about to go on a pre-season tour to Australia with Everton. You'd even checked your bags in, and then, yeah, take it from there.
Yeah, so I'd left Motherwell after a fantastic season. In Scotland, loved every minute of it. but we didn't really want to stay in Scotland. We'd just had our son, so he was a year and a half old. And my wife sort of said, look, we've basically been travelling around the country for 5 years. You know, our family's based near Cambridge. Is there anything you can try and get closer to home, really? Scoured the leagues, looking for teams close to Cambridge at a good level. And Norwich had just got promoted from League One. I spoke to my agent and said, can you put a phone call in, see what they're doing for goalkeepers? Because I knew they had Fraser Forster on loan in the League One season. But I'd heard that Newcastle wanted a fair bit of money for him, and I don't think Norwich were in a position to do it. So he put the phone call into Paul Lambert, and he said, yeah. He said, I'll put him on the list. He's second on the list. We're trying to do Fraser, but if we can't, then we'll bring John in. And it got to a point where, as you say, we were about to go on pre-season tour all the way to Australia. So it was like, right, is it going to get done? Is it not? And I hadn't heard anything. So I was like, right, let's go to Australia then. Put my bags on and everything, and then just about to walk through into the terminal, into the lounge, and David Moyes has walked through and gone, John, just hold on a second. Don't put your bags on yet. We think we're going to get a deal done with Norwich. At that point, I've gone, I've literally just put my bag on.
And it was like,
yeah, he was like, oh, God, okay, right, no problem. We'll try and get it off, just hang fire. In the end, managed to get my bag off. He said, right, you're off down to Norwich, that's it. We've agreed the deal, good luck. And that was that, from Manchester Airport down to Cambridge and then up to Norwich the next day. And, yes, that was it. It was a bit of a whirlwind 12 hours, but it worked itself out in the end.
Unbelievable, just unbelievable how that can happen. The life of a goalkeeper encapsulated right there. You did end up spending 7 years with Norwich, of course. $250,000 you went there for, which, considering the mega fees being banded around now, is an absolute steal. You stayed there for 7 years, of course, two promotions and a host of other topics to discuss. But first, I just want to quickly focus on one particular individual, and that individual is Luis Suarez. Now, please, don't have a go at me, but I thought this is quite an interesting topic purely because of the back and forth that you two seem to have with each other, or more the forth that he seemed to have with you. In your first encounter, you didn't concede. You made a great save right towards the end as you drew in that first season that Norwich came back into the Premier League, 1-1 at Anfield.
I made him angry.
Yeah, well, that's exactly it, because that great start to life then followed up with the next game. He got a hat-trick. In the next game he played against you, he got another hat-trick. In the next game, he got four. And in the game after that, he only just got the one. But that is 11 goals in 5 appearances against you. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because I'm just interested to know whether there is something in it when you come up against a certain striker who scored a lot of goals against you, and perhaps it might be the same for strikers who can't seem to score past a certain goalkeeper. Was there ever anything in your mind, John, that when you came up against Liverpool and Luis Suarez, that it just for some reason didn't work out?
I think it's just one of those things. I really do. I think if you look at the goals he scored against us, I mean, some of them you just go in, well, what can you do? You literally can't do anything. And I remember after the game he scored 4 goals, I've actually gone into that game and thought, right, I've just got to get the better of him. If he scores 1 goal, I've got to make 2 saves from him to try and, you know, just to give myself that victory. But he goes, he dinks one over our centre-half's head and half volleys one into the far corner within the first 10 minutes. And you're going, he's on it again. And they're genuinely, not just from a goalkeeper's point of view, but I think from an outfield player's point of view, a defender's point of view, sometimes there is just nothing you can do when a player gets that bit between his teeth against a certain team. And I think he even put it in his autobiography where he said, every time I was going up against Norwich, I felt like I was going to score 2 or 3. You know, once he's got that in his head, and we've already got in what he's already done, you know, it then becomes difficult to stop that beast. And, you know, he was a beast. He was quick, strong, aggressive. Everything he touched seemed to go into the back of the net. So he's a world-class striker, and everything he's done before that and since that has proved that. So, you know, sometimes you just need to hold your hands up and say, you know what, he just got the better of me. And but as I say, not just me, it was the whole team. And he was just in that zone against us.
Ever have anyone like that, Rich, that you played against?
I mean, they all scored past me. I don't know if there's anyone specifically.
So that period at Norwich, obviously for yourself, was hugely successful, especially in those early years. We're going to get on to the Euro 2012 call-up, the possible World Cup 2014 call-up that ended up not quite going the way you wanted it to. But at that time when you were at Norwich, you were very, very close to a move to Chelsea. Now, this is another thing we often have on the podcast where we've had goalkeepers who have been really close to big moves, to massive clubs. And for one reason or another, be that the club changed their mind, be that the player changed their mind, it hasn't worked out. For you on this occasion, it was Chelsea. It was very close to happening, wasn't it? But you decided to stick in Norfolk.
Yeah, no, it was, well, everything in terms of Chelsea's desire to make it happen was there. You know, they were very forthcoming in their demands. You know, they really wanted it to happen, and it was very flattering. And as a goalkeeper, or not even a goalkeeper, just as a footballer, you know, when you get interest from a club like that, I think they just won the Premier League the season before. I can't, or either the season before, or they might have won it that season. They tried to sign me, but they were under Jose Mourinho. An opportunity to go to a huge football club, work with one of the best managers of his generation, arguably that football scene, work with some of the best players in the world. So, of course, it was tempting, absolutely. And I've always said it was tempting, but I've also always said that the conversation that I had with Norwich and Chris Hughton was, if you receive a bid that you deem acceptable, that you deem you can't turn down, I would like to speak to Chelsea. But until that happens, I'm a Norwich player, and we'll continue like that until the day or the moment you tell me it's changing. As it happened, Norwich never got an offer they felt was acceptable, so it never happened. But there was never any issue for me on that point. You know, I was very happy, and I think the experiences I've had at Everton were very dominant in my decision to not kick up a fuss, if you like, or not force my way out of the club, because I was unsure if I was going to go to Chelsea, how many games I would play. You know, would I be the number one? I mean, they had Peter Cech there, so I wasn't going to be the number one. They had Tobias Courtois coming back the season after, so the chances are I wasn't going to be the number one when he came back. So it was a fairly straightforward decision for myself on a footballing level, because I'm at Norwich, we're in the Premier League, I'm playing every week. We're doing really well. I'm working with players and management that I really enjoy working for. So did I need to move? No, absolutely not. From a personal level and a family level, we were settled in Norwich. Our son had started school. I think we just had a daughter. She was about 6 months, a year old. So again, you know, we were happy on that front. So there was never any need for me to up sticks and move, because realistically, the only thing that would have been better would have been a financial package. And that was my thought process behind it, was I'm in a good position where I am. I don't need to upset that. I don't need to rock the boat, because I'm not going to get anything if we continue in the vein of form we've been in. And if I continue to play like I have been, financially I'll be all right anyway, because I've always said finance and follow success. You know, money follows success. So the more successful you are, the more money you're going to garner. So that was my thought process, and to this day I don't regret the decision. It's one of those things where there's 1,000 footballers that have been in that position, and 500 will go, 500 will stay. It just depends on what tips you over each side, and for me, everything was stacked in the favour of staying at Norwich and continuing the good work that had been put in place.
When did you start goalkeeping, Rich? I'm presuming it wasn't at 14.
No, I was 8 years old. Wow. So that's probably, I suppose, normal in terms of professional goalkeepers. So the fact that he's missed out on so many years of potential development, it's incredible. But you hear more and more stories like this. And I think, given his personality type, he did touch on the fact that once he takes something up, he then really dedicates himself to it. He touched on the fact he's doing it with golf at the moment to an extent. Obviously, he's done it very much with goalkeeping. I think there's something in that. There's certain personality types that can pick things up very quickly and they go headfirst into it.
I think I could still be a goalkeeper. Now, I'm 37.
Okay.
By the age of 40, life begins.
I mean, you've got a nice shape. Mm-hmm. You've got reasonably big hands. Let me have a look. Yeah, I mean, they're quite big. Hand-eye coordination?
Good. I'm good on the Batak.
Okay.
Yeah, once did the Batak with Radamel Falcao.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Well, look, I'm more than happy to train you. I mean,
okay.
Yeah.
So that was quite incredible that he started at 14, made his debut at 17. That in itself is just remarkable, quite unique for a goalkeeper to then move on and have the loan spells that he did. And like I said, I don't want to delve too much into it because we do that with so many of the guests. But the Walsall one, first, I forgot to ask him about Paul Merson and what he was like as a manager, because I'm sure that would have been a funny story. We'll ask him in part two, of course. But the fact there was not a goalkeeper coach, you didn't seem too surprised by that when I brought it up.
No, because it was the norm back in the day, if I'm honest. Even when I first started, we had Peter Benetti would come in one day a week. And that was it, one day a week. And even that, if I remember rightly, he would come in for that day. We'd do 15, 20 minutes, then get called over. So you actually consider you're only getting 15 minutes of goalkeeper coaching each week. It's incredible to think now. But for a period of time, that was just how it was. So no, that didn't surprise me at all. The bit I did touch on as well is that a lot of clubs struggle with it now. Certainly the bigger clubs that are sending players on loan lower down, there's a lot more due diligence done as to the setup of the lower clubs, because they might get game time, but it is that catch 22. It's all good and well getting game time, but if you're not developing, you're not training to a high level, maybe doing the extra weights and the power work that you need to do, then in a strange way, you come back a worse player despite having a better CV. And I think John kind of touched on it there, that the balance of getting the quality training, which he was thankfully getting from Everton, worked in his favour in the end, but it can be a really difficult balance to strike. But yeah, going back to the fact that he made his debut 3 years after taking up the game, unheard of. I can only think that given the type of person he is, again, you can hear on the call, he's very calm, very level-headed. You can tell he doesn't take mistakes overly seriously. The fact that he does just crack on with things, I think having that kind of mentality towards goalkeeping is perfect.
And he was really honest about that move to Chelsea, which I loved. The fact that he stepped back and went, you know what, maybe it wasn't the right move. Had it been thrashed out, he may well have gone. Because I think when you hear from certain players, you think, crikey, you had a chance. I think he had a trial at Man United as well as a kid. We'll get onto that in part two as well. But the fact he had the trial at Chelsea and the circumstances in which he moved to Norwich were just unbelievable. I mean, that, in terms of a life of a goalkeeper, he was at the airport. He checked his bags in. Dave, you can just imagine David Moyes rushing through customs. John, come back.
It's bizarre. Do you know what? I think every player that's played, that's had that move, you remember the moment it gets done. I would say that. Now, I've never had anything as extraordinary as that. I remember I went on near enough deadline day to Blackburn on loan because they couldn't agree a permanent, so I ended up going on loan. But when you get that phone call to say it's done, pack your bags. And I remember for me, I might have been 8 o'clock at night and it was like, look, you're training in the morning. It's like, wow, okay, I need to get my stuff together. End up getting up to Blackburn at 1 in the morning, 2 in the morning, get a couple of hours sleep, and you're turning up at the training ground, pictures and everything else that you do. And it's quite an exciting time. So to actually have been at the airport, to have checked your bags in, to then get the call at that point, it does seem a bit strange that you'd think, well, if it can't have just happened out of the blue. They must have known it was at least close. So to allow him to go to that point, imagine that he gets on the flight and you get the nod an hour into the flight and you know you've got to fly to Australia and back for absolutely no reason. I mean, in a way, it was obviously lucky that he was just about able to get himself out of the airport and get himself over to Norwich.
Yeah, remarkable. Well, there is plenty more to discuss with regards to the career of John Ruddy. We will get on to that. Just a reminder, this is part one. Yeah. There's part two. There's more to talk about Norwich. There's the fact that he broke his finger just prior to going to Euro 2012 with England. Yeah. He thought he was going to be in the 2014 World Cup squad. That didn't work out. And of course, his current situation at Wolves.
Yeah, no, indeed. I've got a feeling with more of these goalkeepers we speak to, there may well be a part one and a part two, because certainly John's not the only one where you delve into their past, an incredible history that so many of them have. So no, I'm certainly excited for part two.
Good. Well, this has been the Goalkeepers Union podcast. Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Matthew.
In association with GK Icon, Goalkeepers 365 and Love Sport Radio, we will see you next time.